welcome to a very different episode of The Back Porch. My name is Grant. I'm a pastor here at First Grapevine down on Church Street. We are very glad to be here with you wherever you are, right around in your car or on a lawnmower or on a pogo stick for all I know. Whatever it is you're doing, thank you for your time and thanks for letting us be here in your earbuds or in your boombox that you're carrying on your shoulder. It's a real honor, seriously. I'm joined by none of my co-hosts. They are spread to the winds. But we have someone who's been here for a long time. He's just not been here on the show. The director of worship, which means leading our choirs, helping organize all the little behind-the-scenes things that happen on a Sunday or whenever we gather together to worship God. So this is the person who's working on that, the man behind the curtain, and sometimes the man at the microphone, the one and only Mr. Jason Chavarria, or as your name was pronounced the other night at that conference event. Let me see if I can even get it this wrong. Chavarria.
Usually Jason, it's Chavarria.
Jason Chavarria.
When people guess, that's what it is that they guess.
Yeah, I laughed out loud.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. It's kind of exciting to be a first-time podcaster, like ever.
So, yeah, ever?
A little different.
Of
ever.
Any kind?
Well,
you get a lot of like FaceTime with the congregation, so that's why on here, you know, in behind the scenes, I try to get people like Priscilla to come on, and which she hates it. She hates being put on a microphone.
Oh, it's intimidating,
but, like,
definitely.
People that they don't get to see, they don't have an opportunity to see. So, but here you are. You're here for a very certain reason, which was I made a comment. I'm really glad this happened, and that's why I wanted to have you on here to show this process to our audience, which is whenever one of the things we do here on the back porch is. We talk about the Bible, and I always say, I acknowledge that you don't have your notebooks out, you don't have your Bible out, and so we're going to keep it at a pretty high level and move past some things pretty quickly. I always say that, and it was on, what was it, Monday this week? Yeah, we had like a lot of heavy things going on, a lot of important things to talk about, and you had like a list of them that you wanted to corner me about, and it was like really important thing. In the midst of that, you just go, you said that Matthew, the disciple, wrote the Gospel of Matthew, and no one believes that.
Well,
and
close.
I think you said it like that, just to be as you know, triggering as possible.
The snark is accurate. That is very true.
Because that's just how we talk.
Yes.
Because Jason and I have been here basically the same amount of time. I beat you by like 1 week, I think.
Yeah.
And so we've worked here through some things. We've experienced some ups and downs. We'll talk about that in a minute. So we just talk differently to each other than a lot of the staff, which another example of how you did that, that was just to me, just to my face, that snarky poke. But I was really proud of you. I guess it was that same day. You were really in a mood. we were talking about Pentecost and how I said I really don't like the flames and doves on like fishing poles waving over the congregation. And the actual history behind that is I've known some people who were new to church and they showed up on Pentecost and they were like already feeling weird about being at church. And then people are waving things over their heads. Like that felt really different for them. And I've always thought it was a little cheesy. So it's like, I don't like that. And you said, I didn't know you didn't like that. And I said, I'm pretty sure I've said that like every year. And you said stone cold in front of everyone. You said, well, I guess maybe you said that, but since you weren't the senior pastor, I didn't listen to anything you said. And there was an actual, like, to your right, I won't name names, but you know who I'm pointing at,
uh-huh.
Like, gasped that you would say that.
Well, I didn't say exactly that
no,
way,
you
but
literally,
that's a very close approximation.
You said that.
I said you weren't senior pastor, so I ignored it.
Oh, okay. And I said, I respect that you can say that in front of everyone. Like, that I respect you for that. Yeah, so that's just giving them a little bit of insight into our dynamic and the way
right.
that we work. And so, but back to the actual point in the conversation, I mentioned, I was just saying on the podcast that Matthew was written by Matthew. And yes, obviously the answer is way more complex than that. And it's really difficult to know. And so let me set this up and then I'll let you present your point. But to say, the authorship of all the books of the Bible is difficult to nail down, and that's for a variety of reasons. All of the Old Testament is extremely old. There's a big age gap between the Old Testament and New Testament. And all of these books are clearly a collaborative effort. And some of the earliest books of the Old Testament have clearly been edited and updated because language itself, all of human language, has changed so much. And you can see there's evidence that the language has been updated as they were writing down, recording, sharing. You know, they were doing really very normal editing things. Now we get to the New Testament, and this is really first century stuff in Rome, in the ancient Near East, and really under the Roman Empire. We have these four Gospels to start with. They're not the only ones that are worth looking at, but we'll keep it there. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now, those are names of important early church figures. Matthew is the name of one of the disciples. Mark is the name of this figure we see in the book of Acts, whose full name is John Mark. We see his mother's involved. We see him go back and forth. He travels with Paul, gets on Paul's nerves for a while, gets back with Paul's crew. Then we see Luke. Luke is another traveling partner, not an original disciple. He's someone who is described as a doctor. And really, when you look at the Gospel of Luke, you can see this is a highly educated person writing this, really the highest level of understanding of the Greek language. You know, it is sometimes it's easy to just dismiss the New Testament as being written in Koine Greek or Common Greek. That's not really true. It ranges from the letters of Peter, 1st and 2nd Peter, which are written in crayon, basically. Like the grammar is, you really get a sense of, I am sitting in a boat with an old, blue-collar, wise person, and I'm taking in his words. Now, and if you have that real-life experience of being with someone like that, you know, really salt-of-the-earth kind of guy, his grammar's not going to be great, mm-hmm. All right? But yeah, that doesn't matter, because you have this real, that's the letters of Peter. Luke is the opposite. It's not Koine Greek, it's high classical Greek, using structures and syntax that you don't see in any other book of the New Testament. That's who we're dealing with here. The Gospel of John is a really beautifully crafted, artistic presentation of a very different gospel, a very different message around the life of Jesus. And so we have these books, these documents, and it's too quick and easy to say these were written by an individual. They clearly were written by a team, a crew. There was a lot of help. There was a lot of sharing of information. Matthew, Mark, and Luke run very parallel. We call them the synoptics. That's just a fancy word for they're basically the same in terms of their structure. And so that there's a lot to it. And they're not putting in the margins. They're not putting in the notes. I wrote this. I did this part. Here's my whole team of editors. I want to be sure to acknowledge everyone who is involved. They're not doing that. That's not a thing that existed, first of all, in their world. But especially if you think about what they were doing at the time, establishing the church, traveling, preaching, launching new churches, even if that were a normal thing, these guys wouldn't have had time for it anyway. And so we come to a book like Matthew. And it does claim to be written by a guy named Matthew. There are certain signs in there, though, that the writer, as he's writing it, it seems to be acknowledging knowledge of the destruction of the temple in 70 by Titus and Vespasian, where they really sieged the entire area and then spent over a year on Jerusalem alone. And then once they finally conquered Jerusalem, they leveled it all the way to the ground. And they took all the things that they collected there whenever they destroyed the temple. They took them back to Rome, and they built a giant arch to celebrate this. And it's still there. It's like just south, I think. An expert will get me. I should pull this up before I say this, but I'm pretty sure it's just south of the Colosseum, just right there by the ruins of the ancient city center of Rome. It's right there. And you can see on this arch the menorahs and other things that they're really clearly saying, we leveled Jerusalem, we took all this stuff, we brought it back. Part of it to establish their new dynasty, they're a father and son team. And that's there. And so you can tell in the writer of Matthew seems to hint that he knows that this not only will happen, but has happened, which that's year 70. Well, that makes it quite a ways on from Jesus' death. So was Matthew even still alive at that point to have even written or at least written this final edition? So that's a big question mark. So that's, all right, Jason, so did I make your argument for you, or I've got more to say, but I want to throw to you and say, is that what you were referencing?
That's one of the things that was referencing, you know, talking about the composition, the authorships of the Synoptic Gospels, just kind of as a background, both Grant and I have seminary degrees from Perkins. And so I think Grant was just a couple of years after me in seminary. And when I went to seminary and it was just putting my toes in the water to see if this God thing, serving God in the church, was something that I wanted to do. And I took to it in my mind like a fish to water. I mean, I just loved everything about school, about serving in church. And New Testament was one of my favorite courses. I had a fantastic New Testament professor who's still there. Shout out to Jamie Clark Soles. And kind of introduced me to the idea of how the Gospels are, by scholarly consensus, constructed in such a way, who had what source as they were composing the Bible. And none of this can be absolutely 100% verified. It's just a scholarly opinion. But the idea was that Mark was written first. Mark was the first gospel. Those of you that know the Gospel of Mark know that it is the shortest gospel. It's very concise. The characters are a little rough around the edges. They kind of get redeemed in later editions of the story, if that is indeed the case. So people think that Mark was the first gospel, and that both Matthew and Luke had Mark's gospel as they were composing their own gospel, as well as a couple of other sources, particularly the sayings of Jesus that's called Q. And so we can see evidence of that. For example, if I've got my numbers right, almost the entirety of Mark is included in the Gospel of Matthew. I think it's 660 verses of 661 verses of Mark are included in Matthew. And so you kind of have to deal with this idea that somebody had each other's source. Somebody had each other's book to extrapolate upon, to add some other source material to in order to complete the gospel that they ended up with. And what's interesting to me, one of the most fascinating things, is that, for example, Matthew and Luke, they have very different slants. They focus somewhat on different things. Luke is the Sunday school Jesus, the Jesus that you encounter in Sunday school, "Let the children come to me." And the birth narratives that are both included in Matthew and Luke. Matthew talks about kings coming to honor Jesus, whereas Luke is more about the shepherds, the lowliest of society, coming and honoring Jesus. And so it seems like the scholarly consensus, of which none can be proved, is that there were sources that were available that were used by all three of the synoptic gospel writers, which order can be debated. But I would say, and Grant may disagree, that the scholarly consensus is that Mark and this other source called Q were sources that both Matthew and Luke used to compose their gospel, imparting kind of what was important to them into their story.
And I think that's certainly a reasonable theory, but that's all it is. And that's why I don't like spend a lot of time on it on here, is because it's guesswork, which, again, if they didn't tell us the details of the publication process, how would we have any idea? And yes, they were clearly sharing a lot of information, but also at the same time writing to a different audience, trying to write for a different reason. What my issue with the general consensus among scholarship, well, two things. One is you have early church leaders. So Irenaeus is one of them. He's not the only one who did some writing just kind of about what the church is doing, what his beliefs are, what's happening. And he, and again, this is a generation later, okay? So he knew some of these people. He knew John. And, you know, he talks about getting to know them, getting to know this work, and he seems to, and he's not the only one again, but they seem to already at this point state a belief that these books were written or at least supervised by, or these stories were being told by these individuals. And not as concerned, obviously, I think being so close to it and so close to the work at that time, Now I was concerned with, hey, did Matthew literally write all of this of the version that we have received? I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying is to completely separate a disciple who's named to the book from this process completely, to completely say he didn't have anything to do with it. I feel like that's more extreme than saying that he wrote it all, which I'm not saying that either. I'm saying that there was a process to record the story, to share this, and to send it with people as they traveled. I think that's starting pretty a lot earlier than we have ever, than scholarship wants to say. I just think that whenever you start theorizing and looking at it a little bit too long, you can come up with something that, frankly, is less probable, not more. Mm-hmm. And that's a concern that I have, because it comes back to, and there's a branch of philosophy that was born in study of the Bible and study of theology, which is epistemology, which is the study of justified knowledge. Now, I've only known one person who had a degree in epistemology. He worked for Lockheed Martin. He led a team that was testing just theories of weaponry that can be made and put on jets, fighter jets of the future generations. Like, it was like, so sci-fi dreamed up putting lasers on a jet. How would we even go about knowing that that would be possible? Like, before we even begin the experiment, how do we justify the knowledge that we have to do that? And so there is this whole field of how do we justify that? And the truth is, we really can't. All we can do is, I mean, scholarship, of course, work on it. I think that's great. Continue to study, look at the Bible and study it. But at the end of the day, if Irenaeus, the early church leaders, if we get all the way to the Council of Nicaea where they're talking about this concept of a canon, and they're asking themselves, hey, do you know anybody who knew them? And they come up with an answer that says, actually, yeah, we really do think these books can be traced back to authoritative apostolic leaders of the early church. We really think that these names associated with these are close to, related to this actual work. And they were in time so close to it. Then I just kind of take it at face value without trying to dig in too deep. Another concern I have is, and this is true about the academic process and in a lot of different fields, and which is I begin to question what is the motive of why a study has gone a particular way, and why what are you trying to push here? What is the underlying motive of saying not only is it not probable some of these people wrote these, but I don't believe that it happened? Why is that? And I'm always curious about that. Although, as I've said this and as I've gone through it, an example of where I think that there's a large kind of church Sunday school tradition around authorship, I don't believe it. I don't believe. All right, so take like the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John is very artistic and very separate from what John, a fisherman disciple, would have been capable of. There's a larger theory that there was a huge community around him there at Ephesus that took his stories and wrote them, and they worked on it together. I think that's true of John, the epistles of John 1, 2, 3. I also think, so the book of Revelation claims to be written by a guy named John. I definitely do not think that is the disciple John. And here's why. For one, he doesn't say, I am the John. He just says, my name is John, and I've been tarred and feathered and left for dead here on this island. But he describes this image, and he's writing to an audience that seems to understand systematic persecution of the church. And although Nero was bad, and Nero most likely put to death both Peter and Paul, Nero didn't search the entire empire to kill Christians. He didn't do that. That didn't happen until Diocletian. That's in the 130s. That's a whole nother generation. I think that the person who is experiencing this, first of all, why are you exiled all the way out there in a time when most of Rome was just kind of casually ignoring you or seeking out key big name individuals occasionally under certain circumstances, but really systematic persecution is not happening until now, till 130-ish. That's why I think that this person, but again, I believe that the people he wrote to knew who he was. I believe that the early church could say, hey, yeah, I know where that came from. Because again, that was very important in the canon process and as they were reviewing. And we look back on it, and I think scholarship looks back on it as kind of this vague, long, drawn out, but really pretty early on, they were pretty close to having a solid list. There were only a few that they went back and forth on. Again, for those reasons, do we know where it came from? Does it align with the rest of Scripture? Does it fit with all these things, or is it going off the rails? And that's why, for me, I come back to, looking at Matthew, do I think that Matthew wrote all of it? No. But I feel comfortable enough to say, kind of quickly, Gospel of Matthew, written by Matthew. Credited to, assigned to, hard to prove or disprove. Just like if the president gets up and gives a speech, I'll say, that's the president's speech. Now, did he literally write it? I don't think so. But he supervised it. He was involved. He stood up and said it. It's part of his larger platform. He's associated with it. So sure, it's a speech. That's kind of my way of looking at it.
Well, I agree with you that we can't possibly know. In fact, I've had professors say, you know, we don't know. All we can do is speculate on the basis of the data that we have and the kind of the analysis that we can do. But in my mind, this idea of authorship can really kind of cast a different perspective on how it is that you read the gospel. Like, for example, honestly, before we had this conversation, my thought was that Matthew was written by somebody who had gotten together the oral traditions of Christ and had assimilated them into a story using other sources as well. Mm-hmm. So this person who was a devout Christian or became a devout Christian and had nothing necessarily to do, had never laid eyes on the actual historical person that was Jesus. So to me, that's one end of the continuum. If the other end of the continuum is that this work was contributed to by somebody that actually walked with Jesus, that mm-hmm. touched Jesus's hands, that slept next to Jesus, or what, that actually knew him. Gosh, can you imagine? And to me, that's a different perspective. And to me, it doesn't change the value of what is written. I think the story in and of itself is what God intended for us to have. But to me, there is that difference between, you know, is this, how far detached is this? And if it is, it's still the most important story in the world. But if it does have that remnant of somebody that actually touched Jesus' hands, that's, to me, that's significant. That adds a little extra to it.
I like that, especially when you look at Matthew and you consider in Matthew 18 where there's this description of how do you handle someone that you have a disagreement within a church? Well, you go to them one-on-one. They still don't want to change what they're doing. Take someone with you. They still don't want to change. Take them before the whole gathering. And they still don't. It says, treat them like a tax collector in the Gospel of Matthew. And if Matthew was a tax collector and he was shown grace and given purpose, then it seems to add this personal touch of, you know what, Jesus didn't give up on me. Now, maybe you don't trust them immediately. Maybe, you know, you need some space, but Jesus treated me differently. I think that hits a little bit more emotional when you think about the possibility that he was involved in the telling and recording of these stories. Again, I'm not trying to say he sat down and said, here is my completed draft. Make minor changes only, please. No. But when you think about that, again, someone who knew Jesus, mm-hmm. sharing that story, that's different. Mm-hmm. The early church, too, was fighting against a movement that began pretty early that was trying to say this never really happened. Gnosticism. That that really the way to experience God is just through a special knowledge that God's presence can give to you. And, you know, I have special knowledge and you don't. And also, since Jesus wasn't really here, it didn't really happen. This is more of a general idea. Mm-hmm. I can kind of do whatever I want. and the church is already facing that. And you can kind of see that in the tail end of some of the letters written in the New Testament of like, oh, no, this really happened. He was real. He was really here. And we need to take this seriously. And it's not about me having special knowledge at all. It's about God having special knowledge and working in us and moving in us. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that's going on in the background that made authorship important by the 300s. Because, you know, they wanted to be really clear. No, this is real. It's not malleable. It's living. It's moving in us. It's changing. But it's not whatever we want it to be. It's the way God is working through all of us together. Mm-hmm. Not a couple of us who are a little bit better at speaking and a little bit whatever. So that we kind of talked around it. We obviously agree a lot more than than we wanted to joke about on Monday. But and even as we've been talking about it, let me check the time here. Over 20 minutes and barely scratching the surface, right? Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I just wanted to show that conversation to them to say, look, we might move past something pretty quickly, but if you've got a question or you hear something, like, come and talk to us. There's nothing we can't dig into a little bit more. It's sometimes hard to gauge, like, who in our target audience really wants to know more about it and whose eyes are just going to glaze over, and trying to balance that with some of these ideas that we don't know. And again, while we don't know, I want to say one more thing about that. Don't lose comfort in that. As Jason just said a second ago, and I appreciate the way you phrase this, that we have the version of the Bible that God wanted us to have, period. I believe that. And I believe it was a messy, collaborative art project to get there, kind of like church still is today. I feel like that's the way God has always worked. Call up people to work together, to try, to struggle, to fight, to argue, and to work towards truth that is best for God's kingdom here on earth. Yeah, I think that's how the Bible was finally pulled together. And God was miraculously working in the midst of it in a way that those people involved couldn't even see. But we, 2,000 years later, can marvel at and appreciate. Again, God's still doing that today. I have to believe that. Or else, why are we even here talking into microphones? So don't lose heart. Don't be made uncomfortable. Appreciate the fact that the same God who worked through this ragtag group to put together the Bible and spread around the world, same God loves you and wants to work in your life and make something beautiful out of the whatever mess you're living in today. Yeah. So are you good with that?
I'm good with that.
All right. And I told you this in a text, but I need to acknowledge this to you in front of them. And I'm always pointing. I believe I'm pointing at my car stereo. I don't know, but I feel that they're here. They're here. That was the, like, primary source of levity in my entire crazy day, and I just needed that so bad, so much worse than I even could realize until I woke up the next day. So thank you so much for just being like, here's a serious thing we've got to talk about, a serious thing. And oh, by the way, bazinga.
You're wrong. That's pretty much what I said.
My favorite words anyone can ever tell me.
I knew that. That's why I did that.
So thank you. Yeah, I love those moments and I appreciate that. And again, I needed that. Must have been a God thing that you were able to be a part of. So thank you. So while you're here, what's your favorite Bible verse or story or character or book of the Bible? Or
The Bible verse that I actually didn't come across it in earnest until Carrie and I, my wife Carrie, who's amazing and also a church professional, were looking at our wedding service and trying to choose a scripture that that we thought would best kind of envelop what it is that we wanted the service to be about. And one of the verses that's listed in the book of worship for a wedding service is Colossians 3, 12 through 17. And I think a lot of you will recognize as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience. And it's quite a long verse, but the one that I think resonates with me the most is, and let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, to which indeed you were called in the one body, and be thankful. And the idea that it highlights gratitude, I think when we're in a state of gratitude, that's one of the ways where we are closest to God, that we really experience God's presence and grace with us when we are grateful for all that the blessings that He surrounds us with. And so that's one that stays with me. I read that pretty often.
That's a good one. And that's a good point of remaining in a state of gratitude, even when, or especially when, it's difficult to find anything to be thankful for. That's an important one. And it's beautiful. Yeah, you're right. We don't hear that at weddings enough. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. All right. Yeah, that's really good. And I like how you came prepared and everything.
I thought you might ask me that. So
yeah,
I'm
kind of prone to do that. So you've worked here 7 years, or will be 7 years, I guess.
Yeah,
or,
next month, seven years.
What's the best thing that's happened that you've seen God do since you've been working here?
That is a really tough question to answer. You know, there's been some amazing things that have happened here. And I think we've been in an unusual amount of transition, of staff transition. Grant's laughing if you can't tell. And so that kind of has added to the craziness of the past 7 years. But I think as a staff, just continuing to do what God has called you to do. And I see that in lots of ways. My first big sort of thing, my first big event when I got here in 2016 was, I got here in July, I believe. And so it was November, early November, we celebrated our 150th mm-hmm. anniversary of the church. And, you know, not to say there hasn't been just as amazing things that have happened over the course of since then, but I just remember thinking, what an honor it is to celebrate a church that has been in ministry to this community for so long, and kind of what a mandate almost it is just to continue being the church in this community and serve as it has served over the past years. And that was special to me.
That's funny you had mentioned that. We've not talked about this. That was really powerful. You're right. We were new on staff, and this church had already been through a lot relatively recently. The beloved senior pastor, Ken Deem, had passed several years before that. And, you know, the church, the spirit of the church continued in the face of that challenge. And we were celebrating the Village Ministries and all the different things that had happened here on Church Street and the way that God had worked. It did feel like a mandate to continue the good things that are here. And that was a special highlight. I think about that one a lot. I don't mention it very often, but I remember a lot of conversations around that time very clearly. What's the worst thing that's happened?
Oh,
here?
Lordy!
What's the worst thing that's happened? Bear in mind, I can edit this.
Ah, good. Yeah. So Grant had mentioned to me before he hit record that I might be asked this question. I was like, oh my gosh, I have to think. But what comes to mind, and it's not really, you know, horrible, but obviously my passion is leading worship for a congregation, being able to have a choir, participate as worship leaders, and to offer music, and to offer my own vocal gifts as possible. And then the pandemic hit. And our entire paradigm shift in terms of sharing worship to where we were recording. So I came from a worship director to a production manager, which was okay. I didn't mind that too much. But it's certainly, I will say we did the absolute, we gave it our 100% effort to reach our congregation, just as if we were still able to meet in person. I'm really proud of the work we did. But I will also say it was a beating that I hope we never have to do again.
Yeah. The senior pastor at the time had gotten ill right before the pandemic. And I feel like we had just started to find our stride in that season when COVID-19 struck the world. And it was on my birthday. I was supposed to be out.
That's right.
And we gathered in the chapel and did our best with what we thought we were supposed to be doing at the time. Had people writing emails about how we shouldn't have been standing that close to each other. And it's like, well, you got to understand, I was working with the information that I had at the time. And, you know, 2 weeks turned into a very long time. That was very hard for all of us to reevaluate and adapt. That was really hard. And we didn't come out the other side the same. In a lot of ways, we acquired new strength. And in some ways, we were tired and broken and had to keep moving forward. Didn't really have time to even stop and recognize what a heavy lift that was, just the same as everyone else. You know, that was really hard. You know, to focus on a positive of that, we had already invested more in our streaming services, so we had some better tech, not all that we have now. We've spent even more, but we had a leg up. When I look at what we were able to put together compared to what I saw other churches, what they were doing, I feel very proud of all the work that we all put in, especially relative to our budget versus others. And we made some friends during that time. We've got people who still attend our church online who live out of state or out of town. And, you know, they really connected with what God was doing here. And that's a huge honor. It cost us a lot, but, you know, we came out the other side. So that's a big one. Yeah. Those are good. That's a big high. That's a hard low. Mm-hmm. And really everything in between.
And we have had everything in between, just about.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. It's tough to pause and reflect on that, which of course we have to do, because we're the only two who've been here through all the things that we've been through. And, you know, you can clearly see God at work and God sustaining us and keeping us here, keeping us going. I'm trying not to mention certain things there's some stuff. And it's not even, what's funny is the audience, you don't even know. Yeah. I mean, you know, a couple of headlines we're talking about, but you really don't know what all has happened. I'll say one thing that's hard. This is a low. If I had to pick an all-time low, it's not a one particular time period or one particular event, but since COVID, there have been more, and not during, but after, more death and near-death issues involving young people. And we obviously can't announce all of them. Their names I can't name. Their visits I've got to do today, I can't tell anyone who I'm going to see. It's a lot, and it's too much. So, it's frustrating to me because there's just, I don't even know what to do. So that's part of my message on Sunday is, you know, we've really got to check on our people. As we celebrate Pentecost, which is the birth of the church, let's not get distracted by anything that's not core mission for us, which is share the good news and do our best to help take care of the people God put in our way. Because they need us now more than ever. I've seen more young people, and by young, I mean, 40, 50 and under. And I'm specifically talking teens, 20s, 30s. Seen more people in that age range in the hospital or the morgue than I have in all my years combined. And that's scary. So, but the bright side is we have a message that can transform lives. You know, we're not just here with a Band-Aid trying to help someone who needs heart surgery. No, we have the answers. We just gotta get it out there. Mm-hmm. And not be distracted by any other nonsense. Yeah. Right, any other highlights or what's a good story to share of life here on Church Street with all of them? Let me see. I've got one. You may not be able to answer. Who's someone who doesn't work here anymore that you miss? Like, who's somebody you think about? Is this not, because we've had a lot of staff come through, a lot of transitions.
We have. There's been a lot of great people that have come to First Grapevine and have left for various reasons. You know, a couple of people that come to mind in particular was we had an administrative assistant who helped with worship, and her name was Renee Tielkemeer.
Yeah.
And Renee was not only just a fantastic worker bee who just loved, she just exuded grace. I mean, she was a perfect person for anyone off the street or any new person to come in and encounter somebody from our church, just to meet that beautiful smile and gracious spirit. And she's somebody that I'm privileged to have gotten to work with, I think. And then another terrific administrative assistant was Rhonda.
Rhonda was great.
Rhonda was fantastic. Now, she was more business, but she kept us all on track and did wonderful things, organizational things here as well.
It's funny how God sent us the right people at the right time, because Rhonda was tough. She would tell it to you straight, and she was looking out for the team. And there were a lot of times some people were asking about some people's personal business, and she would shut that down real quick. And I don't think she was as, in terms of able to cover a lot of the administrative tasks of our church and helping keep a lot of things running, I don't think she's as talented as Amanda, who we have now. God sent us at this season. Rhonda left to go take care of her mom and went back home, and so it was sad to see her go, but she went on to do great things. And and sure enough, God sent like the right person to take that place, who can help us go to the next level, who's also tough. But I mean, I'm just saying, in a fight, Rhonda's going to win against anyone. Take all comers. Yeah. That's been a joy to watch as things have gone on. Like Robbie Balbo was here for a while and was a good friend, had a good time here and went on to bigger, better things. I miss him, but then God sent James, who has helped and I think was the right youth leader that to have during COVID kind of thing. So it just, those things, they come and go. Those are the ones on my mind. Armando, I always miss Armando. I actually get to see him probably more often than most people. He was a pastor here, I think 10 years. He was an associate pastor. He left before COVID. Yeah, so he's a good one.
Well, my only comment is there is a certain amount of toughness that one has to have to make it in the church world. The staff world, I should say. I think that's fair to say.
It's a tough...
Thick-skinnedness, maybe that's a better word.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, I was talking about that in a meeting before this, that I have a friend who is a lead design engineer at Lockheed Martin. He's on one of their rocket teams. So that is really like hypersonic rockets, really complicated stuff. And he brought up the contrast between our jobs. And he said that he thought my job as a pastor is harder. I said, well, it's different. I said, here's how I think it would go. I said, if I showed up at your place of work to do your job, I wouldn't even know where to begin. I wouldn't make it 15 minutes. I couldn't do it. I can't do the math. I wouldn't even know how to run the secret computer you have to hook up to the mainframe to even look at your own homework. I wouldn't know how to do that. I said, but you could come to my place of work and you could do my job. You could. You could get through about 2 weeks and then you would die. And I can't explain why, but it's something that it's an endurance test. It really is. But the best things in life often are. I mean, it's hard. We work with a lot of people. We have to accomplish a lot. We don't have a lot of money to spend. We've got to do these things. It's great work, but it's a lot to endure. And again, what I mentioned about when I like seeing young people in peril or in trouble, it doesn't get easier. I mean, I guess it does in a sense. I'm more prepared and able to process and compartmentalize and work through what that is, but it's never not shocking. And this way it's always, and that's it. But we have to go where we're called. Yeah. All right. Well, I've had you tied up in here for a while. Oh, wow. 45 minutes. Man,
wow.
We could just sit and talk forever.
We could.
why don't we stop this for now? because that explains why my phone's been buzzing. People are looking for me.
Oh, I got you. Yeah.
And we'll have to have you back and talk some more.
Sure.
And think of other topics in which we could fight about in a public forum.
Well, I can talk about what the ordination process is like for United Methodists.
Oh, yeah. Oh, because you're going through the ordination process,
I am,
right?
So that will be, yeah.
To the order of deacon?
Yes, currently. I'm still discerning, but yeah.
Okay. How's that going so far?
It's going fantastic. Probably the listeners already know that I'm a nerd and I love school, and I'm back in it, and I couldn't be happier. And so I'm really enjoying what I'm studying this summer as part of the ordination requirements. And yeah, looking forward to the process.
It's one of those things where I think it finally hits you when you're done, but it can be very difficult in the process because it is like getting its own degree, mm-hmm. except different. I don't know how to articulate that. When Pastor Carly got ordained, I was one of her sponsors. I forget the term. I got to go with her, sit with her, full robe, go there. I enjoyed that a lot more than my own ordination service. That was a lot easier for me to just take it all in and enjoy and just be present in that moment. That was good. And of course, I was there with Mike Ramsdale. That was a ton of fun.
We
just got to enjoy
yeah.
and goof off. And in fact, we got shushed pretty loudly in the hallway.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're going to do what we do. What can I say? All right, well, good luck to you. Prayers for you on that journey. If people have questions or want to give you words of encouragement, they can just find you on our website, right?
Absolutely, yes.
So jasonc@fumcg.org if you know the magic formula, but really just go to the website, click on his name, send him an email, tell him, go on, son, good job, keep it up, or ask him any kind of question you want. Oh, one final parting question that you are not prepared for.
Okay.
Name your favorite hymn, and yes, there are wrong answers.
Oh, my favorite hymn. You know, as part of my study of doctrine, John Wesleyan doctrine, we study the hymns. It's interesting because I know I got to tell you, the one that comes to mind, other than It Is Well With My Soul, is O That's Come Thou, O Traveler Unknown, which is not a very known, but it's a we've sung it before.
I know, because you're always picking weird hymns.
Once in a while, I pick a weird hymn. Mm-hmm. But the words to that are fantastic, so look that
up. What is that one again?
I forget where the O is. Come Thou, O Traveler Unknown.
Come Thou, O Traveler Unknown.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I picture wearing a very Victorian costume while singing that one.
Okay.
So, all right. I'll have to go look that up. I believe you because I pick on you about hymns, but they have good, there's so many good messages in the hymnal hiding in there. And we do go through a lot of them, so it's hard for me to keep them all straight. But all right, I'll look that up. Say it one more time.
Somebody's going to catch me on this and say, he said the wrong thing three times, but I think
I know. Yeah.
Come. I really forget where the O is. Maybe it's O Come Thou Traveler Unknown. I don't know where the O goes mm-hmm. exactly, but all the words are there. It's just maybe not in that exact order.
There's someone out there right now who is looking at you through space and time with the face that your aunt gives you when you actively don't use a coaster.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Yes.
That's happening right now. You feel it, don't you?
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Well, yeah. Thanks again for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks
great,
for having me.
Great to sit and talk with you.
Yeah.
To all of our dear listeners, if you've got something going on you want us to be in prayer for, if you need some help with something, give us a call. Shoot us an email. We'd love to chat with you, and we'd especially love to walk with you if you've got something really heavy in your life. Hope to see you soon. Until next time, remember to go everywhere and eat everything. I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Yes, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.